This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of February 1st, 2026. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 433. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest. I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker. And on the big deal feature, British Columbia's drug decriminalization experiment is over. A three-year failure with deadly results. My guest is mental health and addiction specialist Dr. Julian Summers of Simon Fraser University, who says it was doomed from the start. What next? This is the big deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. 3 years ago, January 2023, our guest was clinical psychologist Dr. Julian Summers from Simon Fraser University. At the end of January in 2023, possession of 2.5 grams or less of hard drugs like heroin, cocaine, and even fentanyl was decriminalized here in British Columbia. And it was start of a three-year experiment granted by the federal government and undertaken by the provincial government here in British Columbia. Now, advocates for harm reduction and safe supply said it at the time it didn't go far enough. And then advocates for recovery who want to help addicts get off drugs so they can lead normal, healthy lives said it was a big step in the wrong direction. At the time, more than 10,000 people had died of drug overdoses in British Columbia since a public health emergency was declared in 2016. And here we are in 2026, and that number is around 16,000. Is known. And at the time when I had Dr. Julian Summers on the podcast, he said this.
It isn't poised to have a positive impact. The way that we've gone about it should, in my view, lead to some concerns about not only increased harms to people who are currently at risk, but the further distribution of risk through the population. And that is principally and straightforwardly related to the resulting expansion of the sale and distribution of drugs.
And coming back on the podcast is Dr. Julian Summers, because the three-year experiment has declared over. Where did this all go wrong?
Well, it's great to be with you, Bob. I think it went wrong right at the beginning. This is a plan that has been incubated now going back a number of years prior to the declaration of that public health emergency that you referred to. There were groups mobilizing to address addiction, and many actors in BC. Coming from prior work on infectious diseases, so HIV, AIDS, hepatitis, beginning to stake out interests in responding to addiction and responding in much the same ways that they had successfully addressed infections. So using predominantly pharmaceuticals and leaning very heavily on biomedical interventions. So the plans were always very clearly to use BC as a kind of a test site internationally to both decriminalize possession and, with the benefit of that legal change, begin introducing and ramping up the pharmaceutical alternatives to addictive drugs was the hope. But that path, and that's essentially it. It's one and two. We can see now, here we are, as you pointed out, 10 years into this declared emergency, we have no evidence of success. In fact, we have very little evidence, which on its own is alarming. But the evidence of our senses, the evidence throughout our communities, is the evidence of failure and what's driving these political decisions. At the same time, we have made no progress on the areas of addiction science that most people in the field would consider the most important: prevention of new cases, and helping people who are in crisis to escape crisis. And the way we do that is by helping people to reintegrate into healthy settings, occupations, housing, and so on. No progress at all. So, you know, where it leaves us is a kind of a scorched earth battlefield scenario where we have many, many people that have been harmed. Of course, the people who we've lost, but the extent of spread of harms throughout communities is nothing short of devastating. First responders, businesses, families, schools, all kinds of impacts. And we now in the context of a financial deficit, which we didn't have when this was beginning, we have the added burden of making sure that we not only are redirecting our attention to areas of policy that are much more likely to make a difference, but that we have a very sound business case to associate any advocacy for those things, precisely because we're now in an environment of economic scarcity at the public level.
Where was the turning point? Was it with the Dilaudid scandal, the diversion of the harm reduction medication that was given to addicts by pharmacies, and then found out from some very good reporting by CBC Global and Northern Beat that addicts were then taking that medication and selling it to dealers and getting fentanyl? Was that the turning point, or was there something else?
I think you're correct that was the point at which a critical mass of the public became aware of the fact of diversion, the fact that this was not offsetting harm, but rather was introducing into the lives of people who are living in poverty, living with addiction. So let's just pause for a second and emphasize addiction is defined as the loss of one's ability to control a behavior that's harmful to oneself or to others. Loss of control is central. And so people began to see that this was not offsetting harm. This was actually adding harm, because what we were doing was introducing a fungible asset, not a desirable alternative to fentanyl or other drugs. So the fungible asset gets commercialized, sold to interested customers locally in BC, in our communities, and then packaged and reported and exported elsewhere. As you've mentioned, that's been now widely reported. So I think that's the public turning point. But the turning point privately and within the sort of the policy sphere occurred much before that, because we knew from a range of publications, including in BC and in Vancouver, that drugs were being treated as fungible assets. They were already being diverted. We should always have expected that. So the error occurred, in my view, when the government permitted people who had very strong positions of power, provincial health officers, deputy provincial health officers, directors of public health at provincial agencies, to advocate for this strategy and form related companies. So we literally were dispensing drugs to people from vending machines owned by a former deputy provincial health officer who was deputy alongside the current PHO when she was in that role. We had a former provincial health officer who established his own opioid company while advocating for these things. Those, in my view, were the initial very consequential missteps that gave rise to what we saw, because it's one thing to advocate for policies and even new services, but the people in positions of authority and able to influence those cannot be the same people who then follow through and implement them through their companies. It obviously restricts their ability as influencers to redirect resources if things aren't going as well as they had thought. At the same time, the people in positions of authority took measures to ensure that existing monitoring of addiction in BC would be terminated, and that there would be no arm's length ability to evaluate the outcomes of what they were promoting. That's actually where we find ourselves now. The government is not reversing because it's able to show evidence of policy failure. It's retreating because of the hue and cry among the public, who are saying it's obviously not working, and that unfortunately is something that we should have been able to identify several years ago had we been continuing to monitor these policies, we would have known by late 2022 that things were not going completely as anticipated. But instead, the government had already taken the step of ordering the destruction of the monitoring capabilities that had been used in BC for about 20 years prior to that. But it's a real mess.
Eleanor Sturco, the politician who was with the Conservative Party, now independent, she got leaked information. And when she shared that leaked information, she was suddenly the subject of a witch hunt, which the NDP did eventually call off. But this was also a battle of information of people in the political sphere who didn't want to admit that they were wrong.
The absence of information, the absence of independent information appears to be part of a fairly familiar tactic, unfortunately, to reserve the ability to people in positions of authority to state exactly what's happening. So we heard this in the BC legislature. We heard this in Ottawa among government ministers assuring the public that decriminalization and safe supply are achieving objectives, it's working, it's saving lives, when there was in fact no evidence to support those claims. Their strength is that there was no hard evidence to support opposing claims other than the evidence of our senses. So that was a very, very, you know, as I said, it's a very, very unfortunate chapter and reveals some of the command and control tendencies that the people who've worked with, especially the provincial Ministry of Health here in BC, will be familiar with. And it underscores sort of the magnitude of reform that's needed if we're going to do things that simply reflect sensible approaches to addiction policy. You know, I'll add that as part of the growth of decrim and safe supply, the number of consumption sites in British Columbia expanded from 1 to 58. And that should be hugely, hugely alarming to any member of the public and people who use drugs, by the way, as well. We know that people who use consumption sites actually consume the minority of their drugs in those facilities. So if we go from 1 to 50-something, we now know that there are large numbers of communities of people using drugs where some of the time they're using the consumption site, the rest of the time they're out in the community. These are people who are typically challenged for housing. They are very often living in encampments. They're almost entirely unemployed, and they're young people. So we had, as this mushrooming of low barrier access points to consume drugs and receive drugs was occurring, we had no plans whatsoever to prevent people from entering that position of risk, and we had no exit strategy. We had no plan for encountering people in these settings and reasonably rapidly, promoting their movement into positions of greater stability, greater well-being, and greater capacity to care for themselves, including managing their drug use. I can't think of a greater sort of indictment in modern day policy times than what we've seen occurring around us in relation to addiction in BC.
Is there any evidence that you're seeing that our politicians are even trying to play catch up, at least to atone for what's gone on in the past 3 years?
No, I don't, unfortunately. The people who are in positions of power in health, in both on the medical side and in the public health side, which spills over into the academic side, remain the people that drove our current policies. They're in many instances quite prideful. They don't want to be associated with any kind of what I'm describing as a massive failure. They don't want to be a part of anything like that. And they're still assuring elected officials and the public, you know, we've got this. We can, you know, we're going to have another announcement. Recently, we heard the Minister of Health announce that there was a new telephone hotline that people could call, right? As though that's somehow a meaningful response to the void that we're now faced with in the kind of the eventual crashing waves of Safe Supply and Decrim, those nubby. That's a phone line doesn't, you know, even come close to cutting it. So what's remarkable is that the minister somehow thinks that that is an announcement in this context that could possibly be well received. That's the remarkable thing. Honestly, in my view, the changes that need to occur are quite deeply rooted, because they require reorganizing how publicly funded services are delivered, and in particular, better coordinating them so that they achieve these goals of prevention and promoting recovered well-being. But that's not going to happen in the current leadership context and in our government in BC. So how could it happen? Well, the changes that are needed affect senior ranks of the public service. Public servants rank and file and people delivering services that I've worked with for many, many years were very strong supporters of the kinds of changes that I and my colleagues have been advocating for a long time. And in fact, we gathered a lot of our evidence working together with service providers around BC. The impediment really is in leadership. Leadership is not going to change on its own. And so from my way of thinking and looking at this, the only path forward that seems viable is that there would be a change in our elected government with a commitment to changing the performance of public services, recognizing that changing public services is going to require changing public servants. Then we would have a chance. But I see no evidence at all, unfortunately, of any kind of insight into missteps, discussion of prevention, promoting recovery at all, other than lip service. So this sort of prideful, legacy-oriented perspective that many senior leaders have is an impediment to change.
So where to from here, beginning in February 2026? 6 months from now, you're down the road, 2, 5, 10 years, where next, and what next?
In my career, so I started working out in this working in this field in at Riverview Hospital in 1986, and have been tracking this, working with governments, the BC government, of course, but other governments too now, ever since that time. There's never been, in my experience, a period of greater kind of public engagement in addiction policies, mental health policies. There has never been greater public awareness that we actually have no system and that we desperately need one. That's come at an immense cost. The people are paying attention because they're impacted, and not because they're impacted favorably. But the silver lining, I think, is that now the degree of public engagement is unprecedented in my career. That needs to translate into how people vote, the kinds of questions that we ask at our town halls. But I'm seeing that. This is not some coming attraction. I'm already seeing that. Business leaders are now speaking out publicly and in ways that really demand greater attention to policies that are grounded in evidence, and that once they're implemented, are linked to specific targets, and that we'll know by our measurements whether we're achieving those targets. These are, I think, for most people, fairly elementary things to have in any kind of performance objective, and they've just been glaring in their absence, and the elected leaders have not been called sufficiently to account to make sure that all of those elements are in place. What are we going to do differently? What are the objectives it's going to achieve? How will we know if we're achieving them, right? So now there's more and more of a chorus of people across different sectors saying, look, we've been making mistakes. If you don't want to admit it, that's fine, but we can see there have been mistakes. What are you going to do differently? Any government, I hope, that aims to capture the votes of British Columbians in this case, and same in other jurisdictions, I think needs to be able to speak credibly to how they're going to make a difference. And that, to me, is the opportunity for change at the elected level, And the cascade that I referred to could change at the senior public service level, leading to greater efficiencies across government, which is completely what's needed. Look, most of the adults who are dying in BC were young people unemployed, and almost all of them, from our research and other people's research, want to resume paid employment. So our strategy has to include a vocational component. It has to include a pathway back to employment. We have none. On the other hand, earlier, in terms of prevention, drugs have poisoning has become the leading cause of preventable death among youth in DC, and most of those kids, in some year ranges, it's as high as 75% received services from the Ministry for Children and Family Development, which administers foster care. We need a strategy that targets foster youth who are at risk. This is not something that is going to be achieved by canvassing all schools in BC with some kind of programming. The target population is a fraction of 1% of BC youth, but they are very much at risk. So these are actionable areas. And for sure they're challenging. If you're listening to this as sort of a lay person, you think, wow, that sounds complicated. It's moderately complicated, but it's been done before. It's been done in BC. It's certainly been done in other jurisdictions. And so we have good blueprints to follow. We need the courage to accept that what we've been doing has been misguided, has been motivated by, in some cases, inappropriate reasons, and that there's far, far better that we can achieve, fortunately, at less cost as well. So I live in hope that day will come sooner rather than later.
Clinical psychologist Dr. Julian Summers from Simon Fraser University. As the era of decriminalization in British Columbia is over, and we look at what next and whether the British Columbia government under NDP Premier David Eby has learned anything and what they will do to take those learnings into the future. And hopefully they're listening to people like Dr. Julian Summers. Thanks again.
Thank you, Bob.
News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim.
In FocusTaiwan.tw, Honnold's Netflix climb a rare opportunity for Taiwan, says Taipei 101 chairperson. Taiwan dared to do it, Taipei Financial Center Corp chairperson Janet Cha wrote on Facebook. Cha said Alex Honnold first contacted her about the free solo climb without ropes or any safety gear in late September 2024, less than a month into her tenure. All five flagpoles outside Taipei 101 have been deliberately fitted with Republic of China, Taiwan flags. In ABC News Australia, Malaysian football executives resign over player naturalization scandal. Malaysia's Football Association was last year found by FIFA to have cheated by providing citizenship to players with no Malaysian ancestry so they could play for the national team. The association's entire executive committee has now resigned, a move it said was intended to maintain institutional credibility. FIFA had suspended the seven players from football activities for 12 months, but the Court of Arbitration for Sport has cleared them to play until their appeal is heard in late February. In Hong Kong Free Press, China Defense Minister vows greater strategic coordination with Russia. The call came days after negotiators from Russia and Ukraine met to discuss a U.S.-brokered plan to end the war, nearly 4 years after Moscow's invasion, which Western governments accused Beijing of enabling. Russian and Ukrainian negotiators held a two-day meeting in Abu Dhabi on Friday and Saturday to discuss a peace plan pushed by U.S. President Donald Trump. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest.
In Willamette Week, former Preschool for All director alleges county officials knew she owned a preschool. Leslie Barnes resigned her post on July 31st, 2 days after Willamette Week reported that the preschool she owned, Village Childcare LLC in North Portland,
was one of four examples of wasteful spending cited by Oregon officials in an audit of the state preschool promise program. Public records show the preschool had received more than $833,000 in state funds from 2020 to 2023 to pay for 63 preschool promise seats, but enrolled students for just 9 seats. In Cascadia Daily News, John Wesselink, Bellingham's local tree expert, dies at age 80. Retired mail deliverer mapped city's exceptional trees. John Wesselink, known by many in Bellingham as the Tree Man, or before that as the Columbia neighborhood's friendly mailman, died on January 16th. One of his legacies is a public repository of more than 250 noteworthy trees in Bellingham. And check out thebreaker.news and bobmackin.substack.com for the stories behind these headlines. Vancouver City Hall seeks to quell criticism from World Cup-impacted residents. And Jim Pattison Grocery Packaging Warehouse to become Trump Immigration Detention Center. Read the stories behind the headlines. Go to thebreaker.news and bobmackin.substack.com. That's Cascadia calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. It don't matter what color you are, 'cause love will conquer hate.
Virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to
The 12s, fans of the Seattle Seahawks, from Oregon to Alaska to Hawaii, and of course, here in British Columbia. The Seahawks will play for their second Super Bowl championship on February 8th. Against the New England Patriots. Go Hawks!
And you can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo Bar? Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news.
That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of February 1st, 2026. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on the 1st of February in 1796, York replaced Newark as the capital of Upper Canada? Newark is today's Niagara-on-the-Lake, and York is now known as Toronto. Now you know. Send me your feedback. Send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca and bobmackin.substack.com. Sign up for the free email newsletter and get updates to your inbox, or follow The Breaker News for news as it happens on X, formerly Twitter. And you can support The Breaker for as little as $7 a month. For more information, go to bobmackin.substack.com. Until next week.